Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the place you can register for Target's own kitchen essentials, hard anodized cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Today we talk with Anthony Bourdain, the chef who wrote the controversial book Kitchen Confidential. It was his take on what really happens in restaurant kitchens. Well, he's at it again. Anthony Bourdain circled the planet writing his new book, A Cook's Tour, in search of the perfect meal. Now, this is a man who likes adventure and the occasional touch of the bizarre with his dinner. Steve Jenkins, the cheese authority who is not shy with opinions, gives us his take on goat cheese. Reporter Scott Haas is in Belgium trying to figure out why the frites are so fine. Then it's a dairy farmer performing strange acts on his cows. And as we do every week in the second half of the show, we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Well, Jane and Michael Stern are ready to roll. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, have you guys gotten to the Midwest lately?
Lynn, yes. We have been to Iowa. Our mission, to eat as much great pie as we could find, and we found plenty.
We revisited one of our favorite old haunts, and it's a place called the Coffee Cup Cafe. The address is on the square, and the town is Sully, Iowa.
Now, where is Sully?
Sully is a little southeast of Des Moines, near the town of Pella, where they make the windows and the Dutch letters. It's a tiny, small town with a town square, and if you drive into town, you know where to eat because you look and see where all the pickups are parked. They're parked outside of the Coffee Cup Cafe. When you walk into this place, you look at the wall, and there is a pegboard where all the regulars keep their coffee cups when they walk in. And every morning, it's one of those places where there's a big communal table in the center of the place, and all the locals kind of come and go and drink coffee and eat cinnamon buns and pancakes, and it's the place where everybody catches up on news, gossip, and information every morning.
Michael was the only man in the place who was not wearing a Seed Company hat and overalls, so it kind of gives you a sense of what the place is like.
I was also the only man in the place taking photographs of my food, which they thought was the weirdest thing they had ever seen.
I think they thought Michael had escaped from some nearby asylum, but, you know, the fact is the pie and the food at the Coffee Cup Cafe is photo worthy. I have never seen such incredible cream pies. The crusts are made from lard, and they are just flaky, paper thin crusts. And the texture of the custard or the cream pies is not that sort of gelatinous, thick stuff that so many cream pies have. It's almost like egg custard. It's very light and delicate with about a 6.5-inch hand-whipped meringue on the top. Absolutely delicious.
Even better than the cream pies are the fruit pies, the double-crusted fruit pies. There are no words to describe how dainty the crust is on the top of one of these fruit pies. You just poke it with the tines of your fork, and it flakes into savory pieces that you fork up with a bunch of, our favorite was cherry berry. Which was a cherry and berry mix pie with this crust. I mean, the fact is we had it at 8 o'clock in the morning because we got there for breakfast, but that wasn't that unusual. A lot of people eat pie for breakfast in Sully, Iowa.
I can't imagine anything better than being a local, a farmer who lives in Sully, Iowa, and coming in at 7 a.m. to the cafe and taking your personalized coffee mug off the pegboard, getting a hot cup of coffee and eating cherry berry pie for breakfast. It's my idea of heaven.
This sounds awfully good, but what other kinds of pie?
Let's see, there was butterscotch meringue pie. There was banana cream pie.
I think peanut butter chocolate.
Mm. Cherry berry, rhubarb.
The meringues are like cotton candy. They're so fluffy.
There aren't a lot. My recollection is that there were maybe no more than 6 or 8 varieties of pie each day, but there. If you get there when we did, which is in the morning, some of the cherry pie, the cherry berry pie that we had was still slightly warm because it had just come out of the oven. There's one other thing we do need to mention on the menu, though, because it's unique to that part of Iowa, Dutch lettuce, which is a salad that you find in many cafes in central Iowa, going back to the Dutch heritage of many of these people. It's an iceberg lettuce salad, very crisp, crunchy lettuce, topped with a kind of creamy, sweet and sour dressing, hard-boiled eggs, and chunks of bacon. This salad is a meal and then some.
Oh, this sounds good. What else do they do? So you've got the Dutch lettuce salad, and you've got
a wonderful lunch of baked ham with real mashed potatoes and an apple salad, which was just hunks of apples cut up with a little egg and a sort of a vinaigrette dressing. You can eat wonderfully backwards, forwards, sideways at this restaurant. I think we had pie for breakfast and ham for lunch and pancakes for supper.
Okay, so we've got pie, we've got Dutch salad. The list goes on and on. It's called what? The Coffee Cup Cafe.
Cup Cafe on the square in Sully, Iowa, in both senses of the words.
Okay, hey, thanks, you two.
Okay, Lynn, bye-bye.
Honey pie, you are making me crazy. I'm in love, but I'm lazy. So won't you please come home?
Jane and Michael Stern's latest book is Blue Plate Specials and Blue Ribbon Chefs. You can hear them here every week on The Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Our cheese curmudgeon, Steve Jenkins, has been tracking down talented cheese artisans for nearly three decades. He's the author of Steve Jenkins' Cheese Primer, and he stops by on a regular basis. Hey, Steve, hi.
Hi, Lynn.
Steve, I want to talk about goat cheese.
Ooh, me too.
Well, it's everywhere. I mean, in the supermarket, you name it, it's everywhere. Tell me about goat cheese.
Goat cheese is made in every country in Europe and in every state of the Union here in the United States. And it's made in a variety of different shapes and sizes and recipes. That's what I want people to understand, is that goat's milk cheeses can be every recipe that they normally associate only with cow's milk cheeses.
So if there's a cheddar in cow's milk, there's a cheddar in goat's milk?
Yes, there sure is, but I wouldn't bother with it. Goat's milk cheddar turns me off.
Okay, so what would you bother with when it comes to goat's milk cheese?
Well, first, what I wouldn't bother with, once again, you know, the negative. I want our listeners to get past buying those plastic-encased logs and discs at the supermarket. All that is frozen curd that's been extruded from a machine and then encased in thick plastic. And it has really no significance whatsoever to the great joys that we know are in goat cheeses.
Yeah, but don't you think people buy that fresh goat cheese because it is like cream cheese? I think they're nervous maybe about goat cheese.
Well, let's get over it. The overpriced cream cheese is not going to scratch that itch that you have to be bowled over by the flavor of a great cheese. You know, all you can do with those fresh cheeses is combine things with them. And I hate stuff with stuff in it. You know, a cheese should be able to stand on its own with a great accompaniment, and that's the virtue and the joy of goat's milk cheeses, is that they have so many different flavors and so many recipes and such toothsomeness, and every one of them is specific to a specific area.
Okay, so what do you want us to look for?
First, understand that the great goat cheeses that are celebrated so heavily are the traditional ones from France and from all over France, primarily the Loire Valley. And what the cheesemaker is doing is dolloping curd into colander-like shapes so that gravity will force out the whey through the holes in the colander shape. Mm-hmm. And when it's turned out, it will be either a pyramid or a disc or a rectangle or a log, whatever shape the cheesemaker is trying to describe. And then they're aged. And after 5, 6, 7, 8 weeks, you don't have cream cheese anymore. You've got a serious cheese that's got serious flavor, that's very complex and great toothsomeness, and a lovely outside that's become beige and perhaps spotted with mold. Never saw plastic. Plastic will suffocate it. These cheeses are meant to breathe. And that's the serious goat cheese that we're referring to, but certainly not all of it by any means. For instance, shabishou, C-H-A-B-I-C-H-O-U. It's a term of endearment for a little goat, but it also has a tremendous reputation as being a goat's milk cheese from the Charente part of France, over in the west side and just south of the Loire Valley. A great, great piece of cheese. Also the Valençay and the Seltzer-Share and the Crottin de Chavignol. These are all Loire Valley chefs that I want our listeners to go out there and find.
Anything from the United States?
Oh, my goodness. From the United States, Judy Shad's Capriole Banon, her fabulous goat cheeses from Indiana that she wraps in grapevine leaves and ties up with raffia, are as good or better than any Banon that I've had in the Loire Valley.
Uh-huh.
The Humboldt Fog from McKinleyville, California, has won every award, as has Capriole Banon, in our yearly competitions at the American Cheese Society. Humboldt Fog, named after Humboldt, California, was very... very foggy coastal town, is a like a 2 kilo cake of a cheese.
So like a 4 pound. That's a lot of cheese.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a four pound
cheese.
4 or 5 pound
thing that has a line of ash horizontally through it. So when you cut it, the knife drags through it, sort of spreads that ash through it, so it's sort of foggy. It's a glorious piece of cheese.
Is it, what is that cinder? Is that, what is it, grapevine or something?
Milk ash.
Milk ash.
In the old days, it was birch ash, birch bark ash in France, and they still do that. But now they cauterize milk and turn it into an ash substance that they use to coat the outside of the cheese. And that's a great story, too. It's their happenstance. The cheesemakers 400 years ago learned that that would draw out the moisture better so that the cheese would ripen over a longer period of time and be a better piece of cheese. Now, when French people see black, stark black, diminutive goat cheeses in the market, they literally salivate.
There are all those battles at the counter to get to the blackest cheese. Yes, I know what you say.
Truly.
Okay,
truly.
So avoid the stuff that's in the plastic wrap.
Correct.
Okay, hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Steve Jenkins is author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. You can find Steve behind the cheese counters at the Fairway Markets in New York City, but you can find his cheese picks on our website, splendidtable.org. And if you want to turn a piece of one of those aged goat cheeses into a main event, try my recipe for aged American goat cheese with a salad of honey, pecan, greens, and apples. I'm in a period of long recipe titles, but it's really a great way to serve the cheese. And you can get it on the website, splendidtable.org. Okay, coming up, stalking the perfect meal with the bad boy of the food world. How to fry a potato Belgian style, and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. Chef and writer Anthony Bourdain describes his first book, Kitchen Confidential, as an obnoxious and over-testosteroned account of his life in the restaurant business. Well, maybe so, but it rested on the New York Times bestseller list for 14 weeks. Anthony's the chef the food world loves to hate. He told us all the nasty tricks a restaurant staff can play on a diner. He also revealed the noble side of the restaurant kitchen and its insanity. What you need if you're going to get a decent meal out on the table. Well, he's back with another book. Anthony Bourdain has circled the globe writing A Cook's Tour in Search of the Perfect Meal. Anthony, welcome.
Thank you. Hi.
Anthony, what in heaven's name have you been up to?
Well, to tell the truth, I put down a very nice score with Kitchen Confidential, and having spent most of my life penned up in a small kitchen, not seeing much of the world, I thought, let's take advantage of the situation, and I figured I'd travel around the world looking for culinary thrills, chills, and kicks.
I've read a lot of books about this kind of thing, traveling around the world. You open this book by describing your hotel room. In a town in Cambodia, there are bloody footprints on the wall, and you describe the place as a dung hole. the whole experience sounds like the deepest level of hell. Why? Why?
I guess, you know, I grew up reading adventure stories as a kid, and 2 years ago I thought, you know, never in a million years will I have the opportunity to see Vietnam or Cambodia or do this sort of Joseph Conrad Apocalypse Now thing. And this was my opportunity. So, you know, on my way to finding the perfect meal, I was looking for some off-the-road adventures. And I had a plan for Vietnam that I was going to reenact the story arc of Apocalypse Now, a foolish, over-romantic notion, perhaps, ending up by going up the river into the worst place on Earth, the worst, most dangerous part of Cambodia. And I'd heard the Khmer Rouge were in the casino business in a remote corner of Cambodia. So I thought, you know, some sort of Maoist gambling paradise. They got to have some good buffet up there. The food might be interesting. And I'll have some fun on the way. Well, it wasn't exactly Siegfried and Roy, but it was, you know, it was also perhaps the most exciting time of my life.
So the food was, I mean, what did you eat?
Bad Thai food, basically. like a lot of the events in this book. I mean, I set up some rather ludicrous goals for myself, knowing or half suspecting that getting there would be a lot more interesting than the destination. And this was a very good example of that.
Well, did you find what you think of as the perfect meal?
I think a few times there were a number of truly magic moments where all of those forces came together perfectly. I mean, just speaking in general, I think the perfect meal is most likely to be that kind of blend of great ingredients, a really talented cook, and those mysterious elements of context. You know, where you are, what's going on in the room, what the room smells like, timing, how badly you need the meal at the time, that sort of thing. And I have to say that almost everything I found in Vietnam was near perfect. It's a foodie's paradise. There seems to be more great food per square foot, and more proud cooks, and more good raw ingredient and fresh, colorful stuff than anywhere else I've ever been. It was really an exciting place to eat, and I had one meal in particular with I was hosted by a bunch of former Viet Cong war heroes at a duck farm in the Mekong Delta, and they were the sweetest, most generous, kindest folks I think I've ever been to dinner with. You know, ate on a tarpaulin on a jungle floor, a clay-roasted duck, very simple dinner. And I just had the greatest time, you know. So I just kept having to pinch myself to remind myself this was really happening. Japan, of course, is, you know, I love everything there. But as far as a restaurant meal, I'd have to point at the French Laundry in Napa Valley as being as close to perfection in a high-end restaurant meal as I've ever experienced. I mean, it was a truly extraordinary meal. 6.5 hours, 20 courses, and just jaw-droppingly good.
Mm. You talk very little, though, about America in the book. Why so little about our own country?
Because I live here. I was looking for the strange and for the new and basically stuff that I'd seen in movies and read about in books. And I was very aware that I had a window of opportunity to get away with doing this with somebody else footing the bill. And I was determined to eat up as much of the world as I could. You know, I rather naively assumed, as this was, you know, most of this travel was last year and earlier this year, I rather naively assumed, you know, well, America will be there when I get back just the way it was. So, you know, I was very passionate about going elsewhere and going to places I'd never been. I also avoided for the most part, France, Italy, China, India, you know, the famously great cuisines.
You filmed this. This is a new series now on the Food Network. Somehow this does not seem like a natural fit, you and the Food Network. How did that work out?
No, it doesn't. I think it was I was a little frustrating for the camera people, I think. I basically I sold the book, was headed out, and some producers walked in who asked if they could follow me around and shoot while I was eating my way around the world, and they in turn sold a project to Food Network. To my complete shock and surprise, the end result, I have to say, I'm pretty proud of. It looks looks kind of cool, and I can promise you that it looks unlike anything that has ever been on Food Network before.
Well, you've trashed the Food Network in print quite a few times.
I'm still doing it. I don't, you know, it's a mystery to me. I've suggested that perhaps some anarchist cabal, you know, somehow let this project in under the radar. But, you know, I guess they've been getting tired of their own programming. I don't know what to say, because it's a very manic, depressive show. They beat me for language a lot. I'm seen at various points drunkenly mishandling automatic weapons. Animals are hurt and killed during the making of this series. So, yeah, it is a departure for them.
Oh, I can't wait. So what's next? What are you working on now?
I might do a little crime book next year, and I'm thinking about a sort of a military field manual on strategy and tactics of brasserie cooking with the folks at my restaurant, Layal.
Are you still cooking at Layal?
I swan through the dining room and take credit for others' toil now and again, but I'd love to tell you that, oh yeah, I'm behind the stove every night still working, but in fact I'm not. A very talented French guy is really handling the day-to-day for me. I'm kind of like a casino greeter now, you know. I stand by the door and wave.
If you start doing Wayne Newton, then we know all is lost.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Hey, Anthony, thank you.
Thank you.
Anthony Bourdain is author of A Cook's Tour in Search of the Perfect Meal. The Food Network airs the TV show of his adventures in January. Reporter Scott Haas loves to track down foods in their native territories. He's gone to Italy to hunt with a truffle hound. He's gone to a cow pasture in Switzerland to learn why Swiss milk tastes so good. And he's still moving north.
This is Scott Haas, and I'm in the middle of Brussels. It's pouring rain. This doesn't bother me because I'm here on a mission. I'm here to find true Belgian cuisine. And I'm standing in front of a large white trailer, and this is one of the pinnacles of Belgian cuisine. It's a frite truck. These are the French fries, and inside the frite truck there are three people selling frite. Do you speak English?
Yes, a little bit.
And a little bit of English and some French. Maybe you can help me translate this?
Yes, okay, no problem.
Okay, thank you. Could you just introduce me to this person?
Oui, c'est bon.
My name is Scott Haas. Could you tell me your name?
My name is Nicolas.
Pleased to meet you.
Pleased to meet you. So this is your free truck? How many years have you been here?
Oh, ça fait quand même 20 ans.
It's 20 years.
20 years? You yourself?
Pas vous-même. It's a family who is there.
And it must be very popular to be here 20 years.
C'est très populaire d'être ici dans le quartier.
C'est réputé pour être une des meilleures films frites de Bruxelles.
It's one of the most famous frites in Brussels.
And there must be a reason why it's so popular.
Le week-end.
They are open all the day and all the night. So all the people who are going to dance and so in the evening, they come at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning to have frites.
So it's open 24 hours?
Yes.
You know, I've never been inside a frite truck. Would you ask them if we can go inside and take a look at what they do?
Et c'est possible qu'ils rentrent pour voir comment vous faites?
Oui, bien sûr.
They're going to let us inside the frite truck, and there's a man, in fact, eating frites. His lips are covered in mayonnaise.
Got it.
Hope he enjoys it. Hope it's worth the effort. Oh, look at this. Now, what is this? What is this? Yeah, this is interesting. I'm standing in front of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8 large barrels, and it's freshly cut potatoes, and they're in. Are they in water?
Oui,
oui, c'est dans l'eau pour qu'elle noircisse pas, pour qu'elle garde. Mais c'est tous les jours.
So it's really fresh, it's in water, and every day there are persons who cut the potatoes. It's not surgelé. Hein?
It's not what?
Surgelé. It's not frozen. It's not frozen.
Now, why are they putting the potatoes in the water?
It's because if it's not in water, the frit is becoming black, and it's not beautiful, and it's not very good.
Et après, on les laisse tremper là.
So this now they dry out.
Yes, they dry out.
Wow, we're inside. Okay, we're following him now. There's some people out there. I could sell frites to them, I guess. Now this is boiling hot oil. I probably should not get so close, right?
No, not too close because it's very hot. But maybe you can. They put it twice in oil. One first, and then it's going out, and then a second time.
So the fries that I see over there,
yes,
those have been fried once.
Yes, it's dry, and then a second time.
So you have to do that. You must do that.
Yes. Oh, and after a good sauce with.
Oh yeah, what are the sauces? I see all these different sauces.
Ah. 30 sauces.
30 sauces?
30 sauces.
For example.
Le ketchup à l'américaine.
Okay.
Ça marche pas tellement. Andalouse, maison, mayonnaise, samouraï, tartare, américain, cocktail, pili pili.
What is your favorite?
Quelle est votre préférée?
Ma préférée, c'est Andalouse.
Andalouse.
And what's the Andalouse? What is that?
C'est piquant.
Spicy.
Hot, a little bit spicy.
So they wrap the frites in paper. Now, this sort of puts an end to the lie that French fries are French.
Andalouse,
absolutely. So these are very delicious, and they're Belgian frites, right?
Uh-huh.
So why does everyone call them French fries? Why shouldn't they be calling them?
It's really a Belgian specialty, and when there are a person from France who are coming, they say that the frites here are better than in France.
I think it must be true. So maybe we should all tell the French government to stop this.
La bonne frite, c'est la frite belge.
Voilà. The good fruit is the Belgian fry.
I think it's true. Yeah, these are delicious. Let me try another one of these. It's wonderful.
Beautiful.
It's better than McDonald's.
Yeah, 100%. Well, I wanted to thank you for teaching me about the Belgian fries.
No problem.
Thank you very much.
Merci à vous.
Do you know that evidently those Belgians eat more fried potatoes than anybody else on earth? Reporter Scott Haas has his home base in Boston.
Hello. How'd you get my number?
To the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me.
What's the best time?
Tell me and I'll be around.
The lines are officially open for your calls, and the best time is right now. Reach us at 800-537-5252, and we'll talk. Okay, let's see. Who has been waiting patiently? We've got Billy on the line. Hey, so Billy, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I'm looking for ideas for vegetarian main dishes for holiday dinner. We're located in a college town and like to include international students in our celebrations. Mm-hmm. And that's always a challenge because we frequently have some vegetarians among the group.
Oh, golly. You know, this is something everybody's facing these days because so many people are dealing with some kind of, I'm not eating meat, I'm not eating any animal product, a lot more than before. So, you know, I think this is a good question for everybody who's listening. A couple of things. One thing that comes to mind is to make something look festive. And by the way, I am not someone who says, you know, do a soy protein substitute or that kind of thing. Do real food.
Well, good, because I'm not particularly interested in things like soy protein substitutes, because when you're dealing with vegetarians who are lifelong vegetarians, they've never developed a taste for meat, so that's not very appealing.
Yeah, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of things come to mind, and I'm thinking of things that look lovely,
mm-hmm.
that are special.
Right.
Because if you think about a lot of holiday meals, just the side dishes have such variety.
Right.
You know, that will work. But there's one thing that's really fun to do, and you can do it ahead and then bake
wonderful.
It.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. You can make a sautéed ragu of wild mushrooms and diced up root vegetables. So think about 1-inch dice of carrot and turnip and celery, a lot of onion, a fair amount of garlic, and then you have a big chunks of shiitake mushrooms, if you can get chanterelles, or just portobellos and creminis.
Mm-hmm.
And you brown all of that. I do the winter vegetables first because they take longer to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd add the mushrooms toward the end. And you can simmer that in broth with lots of interesting herbs. In some words, make it however you want to make it. You're making a stew, essentially, where things still have a little bit of bite to them. You mix in the mushrooms, put it in a deep baking dish, and cover it with a nice pie crust.
Okay.
And you make a deep dish pie. And you bake that off at about 400 degrees. And you can cut a pattern into the top of the pie crust, let it steam escape. And when you bring this big, really wonderful, old-fashioned-looking classic pie, in quotes, to the table. It's a deep dish pie, and everybody breaks the crust, and out comes the steaming vegetable stew. It's wonderful.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. Absolutely, and beautiful.
It's absolutely beautiful. Nobody does this kind of thing anymore. And if you think about it, anything that's a braise or a stew can be placed in a deep dish covered with a really good pie crust, and you're off and running.
Oh, that sounds great.
Okay, so try that. And the other thing is, think about molds. Think about a saffron rice in a bowl as a mold or in a ring mold with something in the center. Braised chickpeas and peas.
Okay.
A curry of some sort, a vegetable curry. Go to Indian cookbooks.
Okay.
You know, and then that goes into the center, and you pack the rice around it. And again, you reheat it in the oven, and it comes to the table, and it's ooh and ah material.
Well, that sounds great.
Okay.
And so pretty.
Yeah.
Thank you, Lynn.
You are welcome, and have great holidays.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, it's time for our weekly food question. This week, the question is, what has eyes that are useless, blood that is colorless, and is illegal before it's about 7 years old? And by the way, you can eat it. Okay, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be getting back to your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We have open lines for you this hour. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's food question. The question was, what has eyes that are useless, blood that's colorless, and is illegal before it's about 7 years old, and you can eat it? It's a lobster. Lobster's eyes are basically ornamental. It navigates by smell. Its blood has no color. And for a lobster to be taken legally in the United States, it has to be a certain minimum size. Now, that minimum size in a lobster is about a pound, okay? This is the surprising part. it can take 7 years for a lobster to get to that weight. Now, lobsters are in season and in their very best condition from October to mid-January. But the problem is, since it's holiday time, prices go through the roof. If you want to save money and have a great lobster dinner, just wait until the week after New Year's. The prices go down. And by the way, for my money, the best way to eat a lobster is pure. Just steam it and lots of melted butter. If you want more ideas and more lobster information, there's a great book out there. It's called Lobster at Home by Jasper White. Okay, let's get back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's been waiting? We've got Mark on the phone. Mark, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I'm a hunter, and you know this is hunting season, and so this is a little bit like, am I going to ask about some birds? It's a little bit like when we used to have berries, and they only came in a season, so
yeah.
These birds only come between October and January.
What birds are they?
Well, I have quail, and I also have chukar, which some people call partridge. And, of course, the partridge are a little bigger, like a Cornish game-size hen. And they taste, they're really moist and are probably the best of the two or three. Sometimes we have pheasant. It's kind of weird, but we clean them. And normally when I clean them, I take the skin off and I just breast the quail. And normally I'll baste them in a little butter and maybe put a little herbs on them and then barbecue them. My wife likes to put them in the oven.
It sounds delicious.
And then the quail, most of the time I'll take the skin off, but I'll leave the wings as well as the feet,
mm-hmm.
On. So looking for a different way to do it because I just, I'm in a rut.
Where do you live, by the way?
I live in Southern California.
Oh, this must be delicious. Gosh. And chukar is a lot like partridge, you're saying.
Well, it is a partridge. It's a species of partridge.
My mouth is watering. So your question is essentially some new ways of cooking both of these birds?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Well, now I'll tell you one thing. This is one great way of doing quail that I learned in Italy, which is butterfly it. Okay, take out the backbone and just open it up. Leave the bones in, because you tell everybody, whenever they eat stuff like this, you eat with your fingers. There's nothing dainty about, no knife and fork, because you're going to be sitting there forever.
Well, especially after we've cleaned the darn thing, we're not feeling very dainty at all.
That's right. Exactly. You're hungry. You can rub them with garlic and a fresh herb, like fresh thyme, for instance. Not too much, because it can overpower them. And a little olive oil and black pepper, and let them sit overnight. And you could even leave the skin on, by the way, because it does help moisten it.
The only way I'm going to leave the skin on is if you come over and pluck the chicken for me, because I'm not going to pluck it.
I hear you. I don't think you need the skin. Who needs skin on a quail? Then what you want to do is not overcook them. So put them over a medium fire. Don't have your fire too hot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because the idea is you want to keep them a medium rare. And I know that surprises a lot of people.
Especially with poultry.
But remember, this is game. It's a slightly...
This is fowl.
Yeah, this is fowl. It's a slightly different beast. And one of the things is, by the way, you could wrap them in pancetta or a bit of bacon if you wanted to, because that helps keep it moist.
Right.
But the other thing is, if you rub them with the olive oil, you see, you've already got some fat there. And I'd salt them only as they're cooking. But when you have very lean meat, one choice that you have is if you cook it slow, it tends to be a tad moister. But what you want to do is make sure that the center is pink, not well done. So when you're looking at the legs, the thighs, I'd make a tiny cut and just look. You don't want it raw, but you want it not overdone. And I'd just make a little cut into the breast, and if it's a nice pale pink inside.
So just the opposite of when my wife, I'm out there barbecuing chicken, and she's saying, make sure it's done. You got to wash that dish so we don't get any salmonella.
No, you don't
want
that. You have to really worry about the salmonella and that kind of thing. Yeah, but in this case, we're just having it a little bit less done than you used to. And then you know what you can do as a big finish? Sprinkle it, get a hole of a pomegranate, make a hole in the side of it, and squeeze it over the hot quail as it comes off of the grill.
Oh, so you've got those herbs, and so you've got a little bit of a sweet and salty.
That's right, exactly. And
not
you
for
can
that.
It's wonderful. You can do it with bay leaf and thyme, you can do it with basil, but you usually want some kind of garlic there, you want black pepper, and you want the olive oil.
Can't put enough fat on these.
That's right. But also I've just done them with olive oil in a pan.
you know, pan sauteed them, and they work. But then you put them on
not
that
a bad
plate.
You just throw them. Just do the same thing, but just throw them in a pan.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But you like doing them on the grill, and that's delicious. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. So try that. Just a little underdone, pale pink in the breast.
Excellent.
Okay.
Thanks for the tips. I'll tell all my hunting buddies.
Okay. And thanks for calling.
You bet.
Goodbye.
Bye bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I've got some ideas for holiday gifts or for treats for the family. And what I like about both of these suggestions I'm about to make is they don't have a website. These are small businesses, and they're still doing some great stuff, and they just don't have a website. One of them is a source for extraordinarily good dried fruit. It's Honeycrisp, and they're in California. It's a man named Art Lang. And when was the last time that you got a handwritten note from someone who was selling something? Art Lang writes a note and Xeroxes it to tell you what the year's been like for his fruit. And the key here is he raises nectarines and peaches and plums and pluots. But the great thing is these are usually heirloom varieties. They are so flavorful. And then he dries them. So you can get dried white nectarines. They come in Ziploc bags. You know, this isn't the fancy basket, but boy, flavor like you wouldn't believe. And by the way, he invites you to call him to tell him what flavor you think you'll like, and then he'll tell you which one of the fruits you should try. So it's called Honeycrisp, California tree-ripened fruit grower. His name is Art Lang. It's going to be on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, the other thing is Dynamite Country Ham. This is ham from Kentucky. It's Colonel Newsom's Country Ham, and it comes with all kinds of instructions. It's delicious ham, and if you can talk them out of one of their 20-month hams, you just trim the fat, slice it, and eat it raw like prosciutto. It's incredible. So that's going to be on the website, too, Colonel Newsom's Kentucky Hams. Cooked, uncooked, absolutely sensational. Okay, let's see. Who's been waiting? Oh, we've got Kelly calling. So, Kelly, what do you want to talk about?
Lynn, my question is about how to make refried beans like you might find in a Texas border town.
Are you in a Texas border town by any chance?
I grew up near there, and we just went back for Thanksgiving and got to eat some of that stuff, and I just have never been able to figure out how they make them so creamy and delicious.
Well, now I've got to go back in the brain, because there are two people who can lead you down this path, because they're the queen and the king of Mexican cooking, Diana Kennedy and Rick Bayless. They've each done books. But this is what I'm remembering from recipes by them, okay?
Okay.
First of all, you need great fat. It has to be pork fat if you're going to do it the way you've been eating it in a border town. In the best of all possible worlds, it should be great lard.
Where would you go about finding great lard?
Oh, boy. You know, if you've got a Mexican butcher shop or a Mexican market near you, where do you live?
I live in Portland, Oregon.
Maybe tough finding a Mexican market in Portland, Oregon. Okay, here's the next best thing. By the way, if you cook pork and you got a lot of fat left over, put it in the freezer.
Okie doke.
And use it. But you could use bacon fat.
We certainly have that.
Okay. I mean, it's going to be smoky, but it's going to give flavor, because you really need great flavor. And generally what you do is you figure maybe a medium onion chopped up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. About 4 or 5 cloves of garlic minced to about 4 cups of beans. Now, the beans, do you remember what kind of beans they were? Do you remember, were they black or they?
No, they're almost always pinto beans.
Okay. Okay. This is good. The best tasting beans are the ones you boil yourself.
Correct.
So you start with the dried beans, and I always boil them with a lot of garlic and chopped onion.
Mm-hmm.
And I salt them toward the end of cooking.
All right.
So you get them so they're really tender. And then you take that fat, about 1/4 cup of it, in a skillet, and you brown the onion. You stir in the garlic. You cook it a few minutes. And then, as I remember, because I used to do this faithfully, and I haven't done it in a long time, keep the bean liquid, but take a slotted spoon and add about 1/2 cup of those beans to that mixture and just cook them a little bit.
Okay.
You're not really frying them, but you're sauteing them, and then start to mash them.
Okay.
And then keep doing that. And you want to use about 4 cups of the beans.
So 4 cups and about 1/4 cup of
of fat. And if you have more fat, it's really better. It's heavy as all get out, but it's really good. And the trick is you're sort of sauteing the beans and then mashing them. Don't burn them.
Okay.
But you get all that luscious fat flavor in there. See if that works for you.
Well, I'm going to try it out. Lynn, thanks so much. We really love your show.
Hey, thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
That's my idea of a holiday dish. You know, refried beans? I don't need anything else. A few chips, maybe. Okay. Hey, the number's 800-537-5252. If you call, we can talk. And we've got Kathy waiting. So, Kathy, what's on your mind?
I have braised greens on the mind.
Oh, aren't you healthy? Oh.
Well, I've had several at some of my favorite restaurants, and I've tried to mimic it and just haven't quite come out with the right texture.
Ah. So what have you been doing?
Well, I'm vegetarian, so, you know, I'm cleaning the different greens and then sauteing a little bit of garlic and then throwing the greens in, and I've tried putting the lid on. I've tried lower temperatures or higher temperatures, but it usually just kind of comes out mushy.
I'm looking
for that kind of crisp.
Oh.
And I've sprinkled them sometimes with lemon, but...
Yeah. What kind of greens are you using?
Oh, chard or beet greens or collard greens. Berries.
Okay, well...
But does it make a difference?
Oh, well, it does, because one of the things... a wonderful cook, Mark Bittman, did a book on greens, and one of the things that he said is, if the stem of a green is more than a quarter inch thick, it's probably not a bad idea to drop it in boiling water for a few minutes, drain it, dry it, and then sauté it.
Oh.
Just because it can be very tough. But you want crisp, and usually the best way you get crisp is almost using something like a Chinese stir-fry technique.
Oh.
And that would be get fat very hot, cut up the greens, and don't put the garlic in first because you might burn it. I'd say throw the garlic and the greens in at the same time and stir fry them over very high heat.
Oh, okay, I've been afraid to do that.
Yeah, and that way, if mushy is not your goal, this will give you a crunchy, crisp green, and especially things like beet greens and Swiss chard. Those collards are a little tougher.
Right.
But collards, you know, it's worth a try if you have young collard greens. But with the others, I think this is dynamite. And try it with spinach. And really keep that heat hot and toss like crazy.
Are there other ways you'd season it besides garlic?
Well, you know, garlic and ginger. Since we're in China now, garlic and ginger is sensational. Mm-hmm. There's one other thing. As you're sauteing them just with the garlic, you could throw in some thoroughly drained and seeded, some sliced up pieces of canned tomato. With olive oil. Oh, you know, what could be bad? It would be delicious. And some hot chili. And you've got this, in fact, what that's reminiscent of is an Italian dish I, you know, had in Italy. So I'm always talking about Italy. But you could also add, for instance, with Swiss chard, dry stir frying them with the garlic, with a bit of olive oil, and with some black olives, and a little, just a little fresh fennel. Because fresh fennel is sweet. Be sensational. Okay.
Hey, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, take care.
We just heard about the Radiance Dairy in Iowa. It's an organic farm where they're practicing Reiki on their cows. Farmer Francis Thickey is on the phone. Francis, hello.
Hello.
Francis, you do what to your cows?
Oh, we do use Reiki on cows when needed. I guess I should also say that we use some alternative health methods on cows as well.
But what is Reiki?
Reiki actually is a hands-on healing technique in which you might say you activate universal life force energy that helps the animal or a person in the healing process.
And it works on cows?
We find it tends to work, especially if used immediately after a health problem begins to manifest. We find it works the best for something like, for example, cows that produce a lot of milk have a fair amount of stress on their udder, and mastitis is something that can crop up from time to time. So we find if we see some symptom of mastitis in a cow, if we use Reiki right away, that seems to go away very quickly.
Well, you said you use other alternative systems, for instance.
Well, we use homeopathy, and we have used chiropractic, as a matter of fact. Once we had a cow that had... The cows kind of, they have a pecking order, and they injure each other sometimes. And we had one that was down and had a back problem, and we could not get her up. And we got a chiropractor in who had worked on horses before, and we were able to get her to respond very quickly with that.
That is really amazing. Is there any difference, do you think, in the milk you're producing because you're using these techniques?
That's getting a little esoteric. I doubt that you could. I doubt that you could measure anything. But I guess on that point, you know, Reiki, the word ki in Japanese stands for that life force, like in Chinese medicine, qi force. I'm sure you've heard about.
Yes.
Chinese people talk about being active in the food, that the quality of the food reflects the qi energy.
Well, Francis, I'm beginning to think I'd like to be one of the cows. Hey, thank you.
You're welcome.
Francis Thicke's farm is the Radiance Dairy near Fairfield, Iowa. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And for all of you celebrating Hanukkah, have a wonderful holiday. Let me leave you with this quote for this week. It's from William Shakespeare. He said, "'Tis an ill cook that cannot lick his own fingers." The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, offering the latest cooking tools and gadgets, from colanders to ladles to timers and garlic crushers. Target has the selection of cooking tools to fully outfit your kitchen. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's The Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. Check out the Splendid Table store while you're at it. It's full of some of the things I like to have in my kitchen. And you can find it right there on our homepage. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. Our associate producers are Jennifer Lupke and Jennifer Russell. The Belgian Free Piece was produced for us by John Marston. Thanks to Sabina Airlines for getting them there. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Public Radio International.